Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our program comes to you today from New York, where a few hours ago, negotiations were resumed in the steel controversy. Our guest is Mr. Thomas Patton, president of Republic Steel Corporation, selected as the spokesman by the 12 companies now negotiating with the Steelworkers Union for a new contract. Until yesterday, it appeared certain that a nationwide strike of 500,000 steelworkers would begin at midnight on Tuesday. Then, following an appeal by President Eisenhower, Union President McDonald postponed the strike for 2 weeks and agreed to resume the negotiations, which were broken off on Friday. The union is asking for a substantial wage increase. The industry wants the present contract extended. On the sidelines in this affair is the government, opposing any contract that would contribute to inflation. Mr. Patton has had a long association with the steel industry. As a lawyer, he helped in the formation of Republic Steel, now the third largest in the industry. He became general counsel of the company in 1936, and he became president 3 years ago. Mr. Patton helped to negotiate the union contract, which is now expiring. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Mr. Patton, are A.H. Raskin of the New York Times, Edwin Leahy of the Knight Newspapers, Victor Rizel of the Hall Syndicate, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Mr. Patton, if you're ready, sir, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Patton, the steel union says that it has made realistic proposals for a contract that would not require higher prices. Can you tell us what those proposals are as they affect wage increases?
The union has made two different proposals, both of which, in our opinion, involve substantial increases in our employment costs, both in wages and in employee benefits. Mr. Spivak, Mr. McDonald hasn't seen fit to state publicly what these proposals are, and I think it would hardly be right for me to do so.
Well, since both you and Mr. McDonald are trying to get public opinion on your side, don't you think that the public ought to know what some of these terms are? How can they come to any judgment if they don't?
Well, Mr. Spivak, if you're familiar with collective bargaining, I think you'll understand that it's best sometimes to keep the various things that go on in the bargaining conference confidential, because in that way you have a chance to give and take. And if you make public statements, you make your position frozen, and it's difficult to bargain from that point.
Well, now here's something that Mr. McDonald has made public as it affects the industry, and I'd like to read this quote to you. The steel industry proposes that our present contracts be extended for 1 year without any change in wages or other benefits and without the annual increase factor contained in our previous agreements. Is that so?
We have made a proposal that the present contract with the existing rates and benefits be extended for 1 year. And we think that's a fair and reasonable proposal, which gives the employees the continued benefit of the very high rates of pay and benefits now in effect in the steel industry.
Well, Mr. Patton, I don't quite understand this thing. You say that the steel industry has refused to give any kind of wage increase. Not only that, but they no longer want the 7.3 increase that had been part of your contracts in the past 3 years. You acknowledge this, you tell this to the public. Now, why can't the public know what the last offer made by the unions was? What do they want? How much money do they want?
Mr. Spivak, I'd suggest you direct that question to Mr. McDonald. It's his offer, and he's the one that should make it public if he thinks it fit to do so.
Well, now, there was a story to the effect that you have made, the industry has made an offer that might amount to a 6 cents an hour increase, and that the union has rejected that. Is there any truth in that?
There is absolutely no truth to that statement.
You have made no offer whatsoever of any increase in wages in any way whatsoever.
We have made an offer to continue in effect for 1 year the very high wage rates and benefits now in effect. I think that's a very substantial offer. When you consider that our employees are now getting $3.10 on the average an hour, I think that most any labor leader in this country would be glad to take that kind of a package back to his employees and his members.
Mr. Roselle.
Mr. Patton, how much money in wages are you willing to give the union without raising your prices this year to get peace in the industry?
Our objective, Mr. Roselle, is to conclude a contract that will involve no increase in the overall employment costs of the company.
But, Mr. Patton, in collective bargaining, that's not a realistic position. The union is asking for a wage increase or it will strike. Now, how much can you give them without increasing your price and not creating inflation?
We cannot give any amount which will increase our employment costs without, in my opinion, speaking only for my own company, requiring a compensating increase in prices. Contrary to what you say, however, I think that the situation as it stands is one in which we have been bargaining in very good faith, and there's lots of room for agreement in the area in which we've suggested.
Mr. Patton, members of the four-man steel union negotiating group, Dave McDonald, Art Goldberg, and the others, are saying that the industry, as represented by the group led by Conrad Cooper, is not negotiating good faith, that they're not negotiating, and that this is the time they chose to stand pat and stop the union. Now, is this true?
Well, just let's take a look at what's happening here. The union is demanding, as a condition to concluding a new labor agreement, that the companies grant increases in wages and employee benefits that will substantially increase the company's costs, just as they've demanded the same thing year after year, requiring price increases. And this same thing has spread out through all industry, requiring wage increases in all industry, price increases in all industry. The wage push spiral of inflation has come into being, and it's been harmful to the whole country. The companies, on the other hand, say now that we must conclude an agreement that will not involve any wage costs or employment cost increases, because we've got to do our share to stop this terrible wage push inflation that's engulfing the country today.
Mr. Patton, then what you're saying is that the steel industry is taking a position for the rest of industry, and this is the last of wage increases if the steel industry can help it.
Not at all. The steel industry is taking a position for the steel industry. Its effect on the rest of industry and on the economy will be what it will. There's no indication that there won't be wage increases in the future whatsoever. We're talking about now.
Well, may I ask you one more question then on the President of the United States? He and his Secretary of Labor generally, it's felt, past 24 hours, pulled the union out of a hole. Do you feel that President Eisenhower has gone back on his promise to remain neutral in labor conflicts?
No, I think the President has remained neutral. I think that he indicated that by suggesting to the steel union that the parties bargained together until a new contract was concluded and that they do it without interrupting production. And we, the companies, are happy to accede to that same suggestion.
You were glad to see the intercession of the President and the White House.
I was glad to see that the union had accepted the suggestion of the President, which was substantially the same suggestion made by the union made to the union last week by the companies, by the way.
Mr. Leahy.
Since, Mr. Patton, and inflation is everybody's concern at this bargaining, has it occurred to anybody in the industry what impact on inflation a price cut in steel might have?
Well, I suppose, Mr. Leahy, a price cut might be a popular thing, but executives in the steel industry have to be responsible people rather than popular people. And I don't believe that they'd be exercising the responsibility they owe to their companies or to the country if they cut prices at this time.
Do you think the second quarter reports of profit, which will be out in a few weeks, would support your statement on that?
Well, I'm sure that's so. The union is making a big point of the fact that our profits for the first quarter were higher than for the first quarter of 1958. And why shouldn't they be? In 1958, we were operating at a very low rate. Now we're operating at a much higher rate. Let's look at the profits of the first quarter and compare them with the profits of 1957. And in our company, we made less in the first quarter of this year than we did in 1957 when we were operating good.
Well, you don't see any possibility of a price cut, then?
I see no possibility of a price cut so far as the company that I represent is concerned, and that's the only company I can speak for.
Are you suggesting that one company could cut prices unilaterally?
I should say if one company cut prices, the other companies would have to follow.
Mr. Raskin.
Mr. Patton, in responding to Mr. Spivak's initial question, you said collective bargaining was a give-and-take process, that nobody in it should have a frozen position. The position that you seem to enunciate here today sounds like quite a frozen position.
Oh, on the contrary, Mr. Raskin. Our position is flexible. Do you consider good faith bargaining to involve only a situation where the companies give and give and give to the union? I think it's just as much good faith bargaining to take a position against demands that you believe unreasonable and harmful not only to your company, but to the country, too.
Well, I can sympathize with that feeling, Mr. Patton. I wonder, though, where the flexibility in it is.
Well, Mr. Raskin, we have said that our objective is to conclude a contract involving no overall increase in our employment costs. Now, within that area, there are many things that can be bargained about, and I'm sure that the union within that area could secure some improvements it's looking for, and the companies could secure some improvements they're looking for.
Well, the industry bargaining team did put forward a number of suggestions for changes in the contract designed to increase efficiency, and it was felt that perhaps that might open the way for some increase in wages. However, the companies have made it clear that even if the union agrees to those changes, which the union says it never will do, that nevertheless there would be no increase made in the wage rate.
Well, Mr. Raskin, you keep talking as though something is static here. Now, let's look for a minute at what the situation is. The employees' earnings have increased from $3.03 since the negotiations began to $3.10 now, so there's nothing static. You see, in the steel industry, we have 30 job classifications, and there's promotions going on all the time. We have about 70% of our jobs covered by incentives, and as our production improves, the earnings of the workers improve.
Well, it does reflect overtime work, though, to some extent, doesn't it, that month
to
month
some extent, but it reflects very largely a good deal of earnings under our incentive program.
Mr. Patton, let me ask you just one last question before I surrender the microphone. When Charles Wilson was president of General Motors, he evolved a theory that it was non-inflationary and, as a matter of fact, very constructive to have a 2.5% wage increase every year to reflect the general improvement in the economy, and that this could be done without raising prices. Do you share that feeling?
Well, when you look at our situation, Mr. Raskin, you see that our employment costs since 1940 have increased by 288%. Our shipments per man hour have increased 30%. So that I think the employees in the steel industry have not only received wage increases equal to productivity, but far in excess of productivity.
Well, of course, the Kefauver Committee says that your prices have gone up twice as fast as your unit labor costs, and they submit statistics to support that view.
We dispute those statistics, and we'll be very glad to do so publicly.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Patton, Mr. McDonald says that common equity demands that the steel workers share equitably in the immense profits made possible in part by their efforts. Do you think that workers have any right at all to share in the increased profits of the steel industry?
I not only think they do, but they have, very liberally. But you can't set wages on the profits of one quarter. wage costs are long-term costs, and you have to set wage rates on a long-range profit basis and not, as the union is insisting, on the profits of one quarter.
Well, is there any way of working out some kind of a wage basis which would give them some share of the profits? Or do you think that is something that industry can't get into? In other words, what do you think is the best yardstick for measuring wage increases in your industry?
Well, there are any number of yardsticks used in wage negotiations. All I can say is that the steel companies over the years have granted increase after increase to the point where the steel workers today are among the highest paid employees in all industry in this country. And I think that anyone would recognize that.
Well, when you say you've granted increases in wages, have you granted them or have you passed them on? Have you absorbed any of those increases yourself?
Oh, yes, we've absorbed them. We've absorbed them all the time. Naturally, we had to make some increase in prices to offset the increase in wages. But when you think that back in 1940, we made 8 cents per sales dollar of profit, and last year we only made 6.3 cents per dollar of sales profit, you can readily see that all of the wage increases have exceeded by far any cost increases.
Mr. Blau has been quoted as saying before an antitrust subcommittee that steel prices had no practical effect on the cost of living. Is that correct?
Well, I think what Mr. Blau, and I don't want to speak for Mr. Blau, what he meant was that if you have a steel price increase, the amount of the increase in the cost of steel for a refrigerator might be about 20 cents, or for an automobile, a few dollars. But there's no doubt that wage increases in the steel industry have patterned out over all industry and have been one of the things leading to this inflationary wage spiral that the country is living under today.
May I ask you one more question? Would you be willing, or as a spokesman for the 12 steel companies, to continue with the as you are at present without a contract?
Well, I think that question
without
is...
Without a strike?
I think
for
that...
For an indefinite period of time?
We have offered the union the proposition of continuing our contract as is indefinitely, subject to termination by either side on 10 days' notice. And the union turned that down.
Wouldn't you be put in a pretty difficult position if such a thing were accepted? Because if things reached a certain stage, couldn't the union then strike you? And you'd have only 10 days' notice if you had no contract?
Well, we're always in that situation when we have a situation that involves a contract with a 10 days termination notice.
Not when you have a 3-year contract.
But when you have a 3-year contract, you know that sometime towards the end of that contract, within 4 or 5 days before its termination, you have to get ready to shut down unless you're pretty sure you're going to have a new contract.
Nevertheless, you'd be willing to continue on more or less on an indefinite basis with a 10-day termination.
Speaking for my own company, we would, yes.
Mr. Rizal.
Well, Mr. Patton, you said that you were talking about this year. Well, this year is 6 months gone. Are you willing to say to the union here that you, the industry, would give them a wage increase in the 1960 contract?
Well, we can't bargain now, Mr. Rizal, about what's going to happen in 1960. We'll look at the situation under the circumstances then existing, and I'm sure that's the way the union would want to have it.
What you're saying, though, what the industry has said, is that they want a 1-year freeze on the contract.
Oh, no. No, that's no way to put it. We want to continue in effect for 1 year the very high wages and benefits now in effect.
But you're not saying that at the end of a year you would increase either the wages or the benefits. You would then negotiate again for the next years.
That's the normal thing that would happen under any circumstances. At the termination of a contract, you negotiate for the new contract.
Well, then on the increase, is it that you believe, speaking for the industry, that the industry cannot afford it, an increase in benefits, or that this is the time when the industry has decided that there shall not be any increases?
I think there are several factors that enter into it, Mr. Rizal. First, we must take into account the already high rates being paid to the steel workers. Second, we have to worry about the increasing amount of foreign competition that we're experiencing in the steel industry with steel being shipped in this country. Third, we have to worry about the wage push inflation spiral that's very bad and is being really leading this country down the road to ruin unless it's stopped. And it's time, in, so far as we in the steel industry are concerned, to stop it, we think.
Well, then, would you, since this seems to be the moment of deadlock, accept presidential mediation, arbitration by special board, fact-finding, or any other agency which could end the deadlock and prevent a strike either 2 weeks from today or a month from today, whenever it would come?
I'm optimistic enough to believe that if the parties are left to free collective bargaining, as was suggested by the President of the United States, that ultimately we'll reach an agreement. And I do not think we need the intervention of any fact-finding board or any outside parties.
Mr. Leahy.
Mr. Patton, the industry and the union and your respective advertising agents have been pouring a lot of statistics out in the last couple of months, and those of us who move our lips when we read have been getting a little punchy, I think. And you never, there's one statistic I never see, and I wonder why. Why doesn't any steel company say what its break-even point is?
Well, because there is no such thing as a break-even point that you can point to immediately. A break-even point depends on what's happening that particular day. If the prices of your materials go up, you have a different break-even point. If the prices of your labor goes up, you have a different break-even point. Nobody can say, as of any particular period, what the break-even point is going to be. It has to be as of a particular day, and that's of no particular
significance. Well, you know when a mill begins to lose money, don't you?
Oh, we know that, certainly.
Then you know what the break-even point of
is. You know that you've passed the break-even point then. You've gone below it.
Well, it's usually treated as an industry secret at any
No, point. It's no industry secret. It's just that it's not possible to define it except as of a given day, and that isn't of much significance.
One quick question, Mr. Patton. Mr. Eisenhower seems to be having a benign influence on your negotiations this week. And 3 years ago, in 1956, you were all equally concerned about inflation, or just as concerned as you are today, I'm sure. But
the steel industry gave Dave McDonald the most generous contract it ever gave to a labor union, largely under the pressure of the White House, when George Humphrey and Jim Mitchell got you together while they were nominating the team out in San Francisco, as you remember. Now, my question. Is there any possibility that the president will use his winning personality with you this time to grant some measure of generous treatment to the workers?
I haven't the slightest idea, Mr. Leahy.
Would you welcome such action on his part, Mr. Patton?
I never welcome the intervention of third parties into labor negotiations, as you well know, Mr. Raskin.
Mr. Patton, is there any sentiment in the industry at all for giving some small increase that could be absorbed, or are there no people in the industry who feel that anything could or should be absorbed this year?
To my knowledge, the 12 companies engaged in bargaining are very firm and uniform in their belief that the contract concluded should involve no overall increase in employment costs.
Now, Mr. Patton, your same companies, your own, U.S. Steel, and most of the other big ones, have captive coal mines, and you recently concluded a contract with Mr. John L. Lewis under which the members of his union got wage increases of 25 cents an hour. Their hourly rate, as you know, is even higher than that of your mill workers. How do you reconcile these two positions?
Well, now, Mr. Raskin, you know that the steel companies own only about 5% of the coal mines in this country. And we have a very small voice in the wage negotiations of the coal industry. That's done mainly
by the large commercial coal operators.
Well, there is a little suspicion that the steel companies are not totally unvocal in the deliberations of the coal industry.
To the extent of 5% of the capacity, they are not. And that's
well, and right. Also as purchasers of a good deal of coal from the commercial operators.
Really, we don't have very much voice in that, and you can understand why, because we're such a small factor.
In any event, you feel there's no incompatibility between these two positions?
I do not. I don't think that we could do anything but accept the rates negotiated by 95% of the industry.
Mr. Spivak.
Recently, the steel industry addressed an advertisement to Mr. McDonald, an open letter, and you said in it, you know that steel profits, far from being fantastic, as you've been saying, have been on a declining scale since 1950. Now, as I read some of the steel figures as an innocent bystander, they don't seem to be on a declining scale. What do you mean by a declining scale?
Well, I mean just this, and I know the industry means it, that in 1950, we earned a little over 8 cents per dollar of sales. In no year since that time have we earned that much. In the good year of 1957, we earned a little over 7 cents, and last year we earned a little over 6 cents, so they are on a declining scale.
Well, now, for example, take your own company. In 1950, you made $63.7 million. In 1958, you made $62 million. In 1959, in the first quarter, you made $26.8 million. That doesn't seem very declining.
Oh, well, you're combining or comparing peaches and apples. If you're
I think with that combination, gentlemen, we'll have to end because I see that our time is running out.